Hello and welcome to the AV Forums podcast for Monday the 29th of August. Happy bank holiday to you all if you're listening on Monday. And joining me on this edition are assistant editor Steve Withers.
I got the pool, she got the pool man.
Audio reviewer Ed Selly.
It's strange calling yourself.
And podcaster without a clue, Mark Borright.
This is all a tape recording.
It is actually. Did I get that right?
It's podcaster without portfolio.
Oh, right. I thought it was without a clue. Yeah.
I don't mind. Either fits.
Okay. Fair enough. Do you want to tell us what we can win, Mark?
Okie doke. Well, for once, can I just ask, how do you actually pronounce this? Is it Stelios?
We don't know, but that's as close as we got last week.
Where do they come from?
I'm going to guess Scandinavia.
Scandinavia?
Stelios. Right. Yes, that's quite. Yeah, there you go.
Okay. Right, we've got a Stelios Audio Mega giveaway. That's open to all members till the 30th of September. And the third prize, we've got NS1 active speakers with Bluetooth, and they come in a choice of 7 colours. Second prize, there's the NS3 active speakers with Bluetooth. And first prize, we've got ML30HD amplifier. And there's also a separate competition, an AK Racing gaming chair, and that's open to all members as well till the 30th of September.
You know what I'm going to see next.
Previous winners?
Yeah.
Yes, we have one for once. Legolas won Terry Pratchett's The Colour of Magic on Blu-ray. And congratulations to him as well for having a username that references a popular character without having to resort to having numbers after the name.
Yeah, well done. He got his first, basically.
Right, let's move on. Hardware news. Is it bad news or is it not? Because what we're going to talk about is a company that probably has no relevance whatsoever to the vast majority of forum members, because they worked in a certain area of the market, which is custom install. Custom install is really for clients who want something that's nice and easy to use and that will work every time, and that any member of the family can pick something up and it'll work. Which, Ed, is a very difficult thing to do when you're talking about technology, because the technology just has to work. And the company we're talking about here is Kaleidoscape, who make servers and streamers that are so simple to use. But they've had quite a few issues to get around and have basically run out of money and have to close now.
Yes. It's probably worth pointing out right at the beginning of our discussions on this that Kaleidoscape's failure is pretty much, if you like, it's an encapsulated view of the problems of delivering a simple premise when confronted with countless licensing agreements, thousands and thousands of pages of legalese, and trying to jump through all of the hoops stipulated in all of those documents. On a very basic level, it was a means of collating a collection of Blu-rays or DVDs in such a way that it then presented it in a very, very slick graphics interface. You selected the icon you wanted to watch, bosh, away it went, and off you go. A number of people listening to this will be going, well, hang on a second, Mr. Hodgkinson, who is you know, fighting children today as part of the school holidays. Mark's been talking about devices that can do this and they cost buttons. The catch is that Kaleidoscape was essentially trying to do all of this above board, so that this device could, as Phil says, could be installed in someone's house and perform all these functions with no sort of setup or input from the user, and completely legally in the eyes of the film companies that produced the Blu-rays in the first place. I think the final irony is that they did it, and actually they'd moved on. I hadn't been paying as much attention in the run-up to this as I might once have done, that they'd actually gone a stage further and were getting ready to do both HD and notionally 4K print, you know, transfer from the studios on a sort of lockdown system, not unlike what some of these other high-end companies have been offering. And it all worked. I mean, my experiences of using it were, you know, a little bit for a longer time ago now, but it was incredibly slick and incredibly stable. But the end result of all of this development, and more importantly, all of the costs inherent in getting it to work in a way that the film companies are happy with, resulted in products that were, put bluntly, they were horrifyingly expensive. And their unwillingness to compromise on any part of the hardware or license what they were doing to other companies just resulted in exceptionally high unit costs. And as you say, they've run out of money. And with the best will in the world, it is fairly unlikely, even if the, you know, the carcass of the organization is sold off at a reasonable price, that someone's going to leap into the breach and save it.
It's so expensive, they had to target the custom install market. That they had no other choice in the matter, really. They had to go where the big bucks are. And it wasn't necessarily, Steve, a case of them trying to make big margins either, because obviously that wasn't the case. They've gone bust. Yeah. So trying to do things legally, trying to push things the right way, trying to make it, and this is the key point, simplified for the type of client who just wants to come in, press a couple of buttons, or his wife wants to come in, press a couple of buttons and start watching something. That's the really difficult bit. You know, you can go out and buy these boxes and Kodi and all the rest of it and have a NAS drive full of your Blu-ray rips and all that. But there's a certain degree of knowledge required and a certain degree of technical input needed from the end user for that to work. Kaleidoscape, you didn't need to do that. You got your installer along, you paid them big bucks, but it worked.
Yeah,
yes, it did. Every time.
I don't know if anyone here has ever tried to use a media player in Kodi, but it's not exactly user-friendly. You do need a degree of expertise and knowledge, and even with sort of Mark pointing us in the right direction and giving us tips, it's still not exactly intuitive. So I guess the appeal, obviously, of Kaleidoscape is that simplicity. It's not a massive surprise that this has happened, given that, as Ed's just pointed out, you can now do the same kind of things for a fraction of the cost, albeit not necessarily legally. And I think this doesn't really send out a very good message, does it, into the world, that if you try and do it the correct way, in the legal way, you go bust. That's not really going to encourage anybody else to take that approach in the future. So it might well be in the long term, it's bad for studios, and perhaps they should have been a bit more flexible with companies like Kaleidoscape. But they've always been, I mean, there are factors why they're expensive, and one of them has been their approach, but they've always been relatively expensive, even back in the days when perhaps they weren't being quite so legal, back in the early days when ripping was still relatively new and people were doing it all the time anyway. And I think that's just the nature of technology, isn't it? I mean, there's been lots of things that have been very expensive in the past, particularly in the custom install area. So things like Kaleidoscape, things like
Crestron
Control, or any of those kind of control systems, hellishly expensive.
It used to be rendered moot by
technology, because you can do all that on an iPad.
Yeah, I mean, you have to point out, you know, Crestron systems, you know, to pay a programmer, some of these systems were £80,000-£90,000 just to control some lights and switching some TVs on and amplifiers and running some macros. You know, you were talking serious amounts of money. But I guess the other question here, guys, is, or the other point to make out here is that it's so simple now to get content quickly and at reasonable quality through services like Netflix and Amazon Video, Prime Video, and also with other things like Sky Q and, you know, their on-demand service, and they've now got Ultra HD service. And these systems are, you know, a fraction of the cost to get in the home. And like we say, I mean, the quality is always getting better. And as long as you've got a decent internet connection, you know, you can get a lot of on-demand programming and films and so on. You don't need to have something like a Kaleidoscape.
Yeah, I mean, we are drowning in content these days, aren't we, in terms of our options?
But it seems a pity that you don't at least have that choice. Particularly the idea of the DVD ripping machine was a nice idea for at least choice for a certain section of the market. You know, it seems kind of quite strange that was something that couldn't come to fruition. And yet, at a given point, the way in which, say, music on CDs was viewed, when you could get that information off the CD, was viewed in a similar manner. And now you can rip a CD on practically everything. You know, it's strange now, like the latest set of consoles, if you can't rip a CD on them. It just seems a bit odd that, you know, there isn't that choice for the kind of middle section of the market. There's either kind of just use standard home kind of DVD Blu-ray player or something, or you have to go to the other end of the spectrum and be a bit more techie to be able to get that information off. For the middle ground, for the average consumer, there's nothing still there, and it seems almost like they've cut their nose off to spite their face now, because everyone is now just kind of getting these Kodi boxes and everyone's just kind of streaming things, so the home format hasn't greatly benefited from that decision.
Yeah, I mean, apart from Kaleidoscape, I can think of no other system that comes close to it in terms of ease of use, in terms of buying films, in terms of ripping films and stuff, and having it all put together for you. You definitely need quite a degree of technical knowledge to have a system like that up and running. And then, again, Steve, the other side of the coin is that it's going to take a hell of a long time to rip all that stuff and put. Whereas, you know, at least when you bought the Kaleidoscape system, it came preloaded with a lot of stuff.
Yeah, I always wondered about that. If they installed a Kaleidoscape, did the installer then go away and like spend days ripping all your stuff for you? But I mean, that was part of the appeal of any kind of system like that, was the idea that you could take a large library of DVDs, for example, and rip them all, had them on a central server, and then put those, you know, like with CDs we were talking about last week, you know, you can put them all away in a cupboard somewhere out of the way. You don't have to bother getting them out. You just have it all there, touch of a button, you can watch whatever you want to watch. But I think, and I could be wrong here, but I think later versions of Kaleidoscape, particularly with reference to Blu-ray, you had to have the Blu-ray in the machine in order to watch the film. Doesn't that rather defeat the point of having it all ripped on a central server?
Well, that was very, very, very early on. They were never able to overcome the licensing restriction that the disc had to be present, but mercifully they were able to, as far as I understand it, they were able to patch connect to a selection of Blu-ray carousels which could just be left, you know, in the vicinity of the Kaleidoscape box, and all the carousel had to do was confirm that disc was in it, and then otherwise the Kaleidoscape just did everything automatically. But it was still a very cumbersome, you know, restriction imposed purely through legislation. I mean, to think the fact that it wouldn't have been, I mean, the same way that, you know, computer games for years, it's like, here's the installation disk, input the code off the disk, and then you can stick the disk in the roof and never go anywhere near it ever again. You know, computer games cracked that at the turn of the century. Blu-ray never, no stage did anyone feel motivated to do that with a Blu-ray disk.
Well, the majority of Blu-ray discs do come with an HD copy, via ultraviolet or whatever they're using, the studio's using. So you do get the code, you can download an HD copy
of
it.
But the catch for that wasn't that, in Kaleidoscope's view, though, didn't that, from memory, I mean, I don't spend very much time playing about with them, I confess, the download, the soft copies, but you don't get the same soundtrack, for example, do you?
No.
You don't get the same bit rate of video. So no. Kaleidoscope wanted the guts of the Blu-ray, and there was no way of doing that other than having the Blu-ray present.
Yeah, no, I mean, Kaleidoscape's ambition of offering you, you know, a full exact copy of the Blu-ray, including the soundtrack and ultimately even Ultra HD Blu-ray, which is what they were working on before they closed the doors. That's great. I just think that, as I said earlier, by making Kaleidoscape jump through so many hoops and ultimately resulting in an incredibly expensive product, the studios have shot themselves in the foot a little bit, because people are going to do what they've been doing already and are going to do even more in the future, which is they're just going to use these cheap media boxes, which, as Ed said, cost buttons, and they're going to watch all this stuff for nothing. And there's nothing the studios can do about it. They really can't police this. They've failed to police it with music. They will fail to police it with movies unless they make it easy. I mean, what ultimately happened with music is that download has become the, you know, the default way of actually consuming that content, and the labels, record labels, are making money out of it again. And I think the studios need to address that fact rather than trying to make everyone jump through hoops and making it incredibly difficult to do it in a legal manner.
I think, playing devil's advocate, the idea of kind of the easy ripping machine, the worry was always that people would just get the stuff, rip it, and then kind of flood a market with secondhand copies, and so therefore it kind of cuts down the amount of money that's directly going to, you know, first-hand sales. So it kind of recycles the money amongst the kind of secondhand market, which is what people have been worried about with games for a long time, which is that a studio will only ever see, or a games developer only ever sees that money on the first sale, and then someone consumes whatever's on the disc and then sends it off. And then that people say, well, it's cheaper secondhand. And so that's obviously always been the worry. The problem is that for DVD, for films and things like that, unlike with music, they've yet to come up with such an absolutely simplified approach for you to kind of consume films digitally that is also at the right price point that people like. I think music has got there, and particularly with the way that you can kind of select particular tracks that appeals to people inherently, so you don't have to buy the whole album anymore. And so that kind of drew people towards digital sales. I don't think there's any way to do quite the same thing with films, which is why we've kind of always had to incentivize home formats with, you know, this has got Easter eggs, or this has got a bonus commentary track, and you know, that kind of thing, which I think a huge amount of the market never even bothers with.
Anyway, so that's Kaleidoscape. We hope something comes, something good comes out of this, and that, you know, maybe the company is rescued, or at least some of the product is rescued and can be made, you know, to work, because it was a very clever system once it was up and running and so on, and there was a lot of time and resources and money went into developing this. So it'd be interesting to see what happens with that. Talking about lots of money for some product that is only likely going to appeal to a certain amount of people. But we like to review the stuff anyway, because I think as home cinema fans, we all aspire to having bigger and better things. And certainly over the years, I've always viewed MK speakers as being a certain high point when it comes to subsat systems, especially for home cinema. And so last year we looked at the S150 cube speakers and the MP150 on-wall speakers, and we've moved up one level. Well, certainly I've moved up one level, and for the last 6 months we've had the MP300 speaker package from M&K, which costs £17,000. Which
in there's no sense being sheepish about this. It costs what it costs.
Costs what it costs, but there's no way you can describe this as a budget system. And then again, it's a sub it's a subsat system as well, which a lot of people have a view of, that you're not getting the full thing with a subsat. And I've never understood that way of thinking. It's very clever, a subsat system, and when it's done right, like it is with the MP300s, you can't tell it's a subsat system unless you're looking at it, because it's such a full range of sound. The system I tested came with two X12 subwoofers, which are dual 12-inch push-pull designs. You know, one of these is enough to pressurize the room that I'm using it in. Two is just, you know, being silly, really. But with everything under 80 hertz being taken care of, well, actually, I did cross them over at 90, but you're supposed to cross them over at 80. With them handling everything on the low end, it opens up the satellites to be able to handle everything else, and you know, because they're not struggling to produce bass and sub bass at that. So it gives you a really nice full range sound, and I don't want to take away too much from the review because I want people to go and read it, because it's taken me 6 months to review this stuff, and you know, we've gone into some great detail in the review about, you know, how the speakers work and how they're designed and all the rest of it. But what I will say, yeah, you had to proof the thing, and I went through it again.
It took
me
an hour.
Yeah, and you still didn't proof it right. You know, there's still...
Not my fault you couldn't decide on how to write the word subsat.
Yeah, we did have an argument about that. But anyway, go and read the review. It's on the homepage. But if I was to sum this up, what I'd say is they're bloody expensive, but they're bloody good. And they're so good that they got a reference award. And they are so transparent and neutral and clinical that it shows up weak points in the audio chain, which very few speakers are capable of doing that. So in terms of testing and using them as a reference point and as a reference speaker, they are absolutely a reference speaker, because you know, we've assessed equipment through them, like AVRs and so on, and you're able to hear what the AVR's doing to the audio chain and so on. So fantastic set speakers. Expensive? Yes. Could I afford them? Absolutely not. But while they're being given to us to test out, and we can use them for at least another few months in terms of our reference point, we will do that, because I think it improves the review standard as well.
You're going, we? I said, you will use them to test them.
So obviously, you know, they'll be used as a reference point in the months ahead, because it's AVR season coming up soon. So we're going to have most of the big boys coming through for review from Yamaha, Denon, and a few others, Marantz, and... it's interesting, because where do they go this year, Steve? Because we had DTS:X and Dolby Atmos last year, so where do they go for improvements this year?
I know what they're going to do. Well, we've already started to see them do it. Yamaha, I guess, were the first, but I've already done, and Marantz are following suit, which is that with no new audio formats to put into their receivers, they're going to be adding multi-room features. That's going to be the next big thing for AVRs, isn't it? You might think, well, is that really important for an AVR? But I think, you know, it's a valid feature, and that would be something that we're going to really be pushing. But you're right. Otherwise, you know, they've already reached a point where, in terms of HDMI, HDR 2.2, HDCP 2.2, HDMI 2.0A, DTS:X, and Dolby Atmos, there isn't really much else they can cram into those receivers. So I think multi-room will be a big feature for AVRs going forward.
And in terms of amplification as well, at least the mid to high-end AVRs are getting so much better in terms of amplification. And again, that was another good test that I had with the MP300s, because they are 4-ohm loads, although they are sensitive at, I think, 90 dB for the front three channels and 89 for the rears. But even so, you know, it takes a bit of amplification. It takes a bit of nice amplification to make them sing, and they managed to do that, which was really quite surprising when you think the price of the speaker package compared to the £1,800 AV receiver.
Just shows what quality they are. Really. I mean, I remember I always like reviews where you read them and think, I really, really want to own that. And that was one of those reviews. And, you know, I mean, like you said in the review, it is to a certain degree aspirational, but it's always kind of like, because it's AV porn, isn't it? You read it and think, oh, that sounds really good. And I like the idea of a speaker package that's really transparent and reveals with a really, really good soundtrack. And a lot of soundtracks these days are really good. Film soundtracks are, you know, incredible sometimes. If you can deliver every tiny detail in that soundtrack, that's very appealing.
Yeah, of course, the flip the coin with a system like that is that if you put crap in, it sounds crap. You know, there's no hiding from bad recordings. But again, you know, if you're using it for assessing you know, film soundtracks on a Blu-ray and so on, because it's such a reviewing thing, it allows you to really make that assessment, and that's the beauty of a system like this. The one thing I want to touch on before we move on from the speakers, and it's a bit of advice that we always give when it comes to multi-channel systems, and the M&Ks do it so well, and there are other packages out there that also do it, and that is, across the front three channels, you have to use the same size of speaker. There's no getting away from it. You can notice straight away if you have a horizontally mounted center speaker that's different from the left and right. You can notice the difference in front pans and effects moving across the front of the soundstage when you use such a setup. Using three identical speakers across the front, if you can get away with it, is the number one way of doing things, because it gives you such a cohesive, wide sound field at the front. And then if you can match that up with surrounds that are also voiced exactly the same as the front channels and ideally about the same size, which they are in this M&K package, that just further enhances the whole thing, and it becomes such a realistic experience when you do it that way. And you know, again, we're coming back to the thing with in the past when we've mentioned stuff like EQ systems and setting up rooms and all the rest of it, if you can do it right from the start and get it like that from the start, then there's not a lot else you really need to add in to improve the experience. And again, that's another big plus point of Subsat systems. It makes it so easy, because three floor standers across the front, not many people are going to get away with that. Yet with Subsat systems, you can hide them behind the screen, acoustically transparent screen. You can hide them underneath the screen. You can wall mount them because they're a smaller cabinet and so on. Yet they're all the same size. And it just gives you that cohesion and that real sense of realism, which is really quite difficult to do in any space.
Well, I've got five identicals, and I do, you know, they're not particularly expensive speakers, but they do have, there is that cohesiveness. There is no where one is ending and one is beginning.
Yeah.
And it must be said that if I really wanted to go balls out on it, there is the mounting and you know, options where notionally, if I could go full Atmos and have exactly the same loudspeaker in every single position except the subwoofer, which isn't bad.
Yep. And you know, it adds so much to the performance by doing it that way, because, and there's some good test discs out there where you get a voice that will travel from the center and 360 degrees all the way around, and that voice should not change. The timbre of that voice should be the same all the way around. And there's other tests that you can do to check the cohesiveness of your system. And there's nothing worse as well, I find, Steve, that can break up the feeling of realism, is the position of the surround speakers and the type of surround speaker as well, because there's that area between the left and far right of the screen and then the side of the room. There's always, unless you set up correctly, and I've seen some very expensive systems fall down on this, there's a gap that suddenly appears. And sounds can jump from the screen to suddenly at the back of the room, and it doesn't sound realistic. And that's why the use of dipoles, tripoles are really quite a good solution on the sidewall, because they fire up and down the room. They work like an array of speakers, like you would see in the cinema.
Yeah.
And that fills in that gap. And that gap, you know, no matter how well you design the system, if you do not think about that gap, it can really show it up.
Mm, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of debate about what kind of speakers to use for sides and for rears. But I mean, that argument certainly, I think, holds water when you actually look at the average living room. Because you say in a cinema, they'll have an array of speakers along the side walls and along the back as well. And if you look at an Atmos system, that has speakers starting right at the front of the screen and running all the way up the side walls. So, you know, you have to replicate that somehow, and that's the best way of doing it. And like you say, Phil, the more you can think about these things in the design stage at the beginning in terms of the choice of speakers, the location of the speakers, and the type of speakers. And also, as you mentioned at the beginning, you know, the idea of a subsat system where, you know, you don't need the speaker to be engineered to deliver down to 30 hertz because you can do all that through the sub. So what you really want is a speaker that can deliver the best performance possible from 80 to, you know, 20,000. and let the subs handle all the low frequency stuff. That makes perfect sense, particularly when you're talking about a multi-channel system for watching movies.
Okay, so we'll move on. That review is up on the homepage. If you fancy a long read, go and have a look at that. And another article which is up there explaining one of the things that we talk about every week on the podcast. And sometimes, you know, like the price of equipment, we forget that people live in the real world sometimes. And when it comes to these things, it's sometimes a simple explanation can go a long way. And that's the whole point of your article that's up on the homepage, Steve, about what is a wide color gamut.
Yeah, because I mean, we obviously, you know, in our little world, we know all about color gamuts because we've been talking about them and obviously calibrating TVs to them for a long time. But the words wide color gamut have become much more prevalent in the last 6 months because if you look at the back of an Ultra HD Blu-ray, it says wide color gamut. You know, it's on the disc. It's advertised with TVs. It's mentioned in the specs for the Blu-ray, Ultra HD Blu-ray players. You know, suddenly it's a word that people are seeing a lot of, but they might be thinking, what is a wide color gamut? And I guess the point of the article is to explain what a color gamut is and then why a wider one is better. And essentially, a color gamut is the colors that a display can show. So your TV or your projector will have a native color gamut, that the maximum amount of colors that it can show in terms of the three primary colors, red, green, and blue, and then the secondary colors, a cyan, yellow, magenta. And it creates a triangle, basically, because you've got three points, red, green, and blue, and that creates a triangle. And it can show all the colors within that triangle. The bigger that triangle, the more colors it can show, more realistic the image can look. And up till now, everything we've been reviewing and testing and you've been watching has used Rec. 709 as a color gamut. That's basically the color gamut for high definition. So your high definition TV broadcasts, your Ultra HD Blu-rays and any HD streaming will use Rec. 709. And so when we review TVs and we calibrate TVs, we calibrate to that standard, and you want your TV or projector to be able to replicate that as precisely as possible, because the content creators would have had a monitor calibrated exactly the same color gamut in the mastering suite. So that's what they saw when they were mastering it. And then by calibrating it on your display, what you're seeing is exactly what they saw. So you're retaining the content creator's intent. Now we're moving to a new world where color gamuts are getting wider, they're getting bigger. And at the cinema, they use a color gamut called DCI-P3. That's a professional cinema standard. It's not applicable to domestic displays, but that's what's used in cinema. And it is bigger than Rec. 709. Domestically, they are now using a new color gamut called Rec. 2020, which is a gigantic color gamut. It's absolutely huge, way bigger than either contents being created in or any display can actually reach at the moment. But by having this massive color gamut, they're basically building a lot of future-proofing here. It's big enough to fit any other color gamut inside. So even the cinema standard DCI-P3 can fit inside this other color gamut, Rec. 2020, and that's how it's delivered domestically. So although it's not the full color gamut of Rec. 2020, it uses that color gamut as a container. You put your DCI-P3, the original film that would have been done in DCI-P3, that goes within that container. It's mapped within Rec. 2020, and that's how it's delivered to your TV or via your Ultra HD Blu-ray player or via Ultra HD streaming. Now, the reason you might be confusing, why are manufacturers banging on about DCI-P3? Purely and simply because the current displays, TVs and projectors, can get very close to DCI-P3, you know, 98, 99% in some cases. And that looks a lot better as a number in marketing than saying 75% of Rec. 2020, which is probably about where the biggest color gamuts currently are. So that's why you keep seeing DCI-P3, but it's not a domestic system. It's designed, a camp gamut is designed for professional cinemas, for the cinema. At home, it's Rec 2020 when you're watching stuff at home. But it's not that whole color gamut, which is gigantic, isn't it, Phil? It's actually a subset of that basic color gamut.
Yeah, and
hopefully that explains it.
Yeah, and as you can see, it can get complicated very quickly, and there's all sorts of offshoots and ifs and buts, and it gets complicated very, very quickly. But if you can get a handle on exactly what it is in the simplest terms, I think it starts to explain far more of what you should be looking for when it comes to a display. And it makes it, obviously, looking at our reviews and understanding the graphs, sometimes once you get your head around that, it makes it so much easier to then make assessments. I mean, Steve can show me a graph now, and I could probably tell you what the performance of that TV is like, because we have spent, you know, between us probably 2 decades in terms of experience looking at these things and measuring them and so on. And a bit like an audio waveform, you know, when it comes to editing the podcast, I can usually tell who's talking and what certain words are just by how the waveform looks, because you've been looking at it for so many years and so many years and doing it over and over and over again. Sometimes you forget that it just takes a simple explanation of something for your average user or even beginner to suddenly jump on. And once you can get your head around what it actually means, then it opens up so many areas for you to look at when it comes to the performance of your system and how you can improve your system and what to look for when it comes to your next display. And you know what you want it to actually do. I mean, you will still get lots and lots of people who, for them, it's personal preference, and they'll set their TVs up or whatever to look however they want it. And sometimes they look awful compared to what the actual material should be like. But I think when you say to somebody, don't you want your TV to look its absolute best and actually show you the content as it should be seen? There's very few people can argue with that, I think, and very few people do argue with you. They say, no, I want to see it as it should be seen. In the past, that has meant, as well, Steve, quite a dim-looking image if you set it up absolutely to the standards at 100 nits. That's for darkroom viewing. And I think because we've stuck with that for so long, and only now can we open up gamuts and open up the brightness on screen without affecting shadow detail and blacks and so on. The only now we're starting to get the real power to show images absolutely bang on. And it's an exciting time from that point of view, where we can actually look at a display and know that what we're seeing there was what the colour grader was looking at. He wasn't looking at 100 nits display, he was looking at 1,000 or 4,000 nits display, and able to have far more control of what we can see in the shadows, what we should be able to see, what we shouldn't be able to see, and the dynamic range in the image. We'll get rid of that old saying of, yeah, it's calibrated, but it looks a bit dull, doesn't it? There's going to be no more of that going forward, which is great, because that used to be the Achilles heel of having things done absolutely properly to the standards.
Yeah, there's a lot happening at the moment, and undoubtedly, when we get to CES in January, there'll be even more being announced. But we're going through what I can only describe as a seismic change at the moment in terms of TV technology. But the ultimate end game, and there is a lot of complicated and you know, technical stuff involved here. But at the end of it, when we've got through this period of transition, the end of it will have a display system in the home that will deliver an experience vastly superior to what we've had in the past. An experience that is not only almost the equal in some respects of the cinema experience, but I would say in some respects better than a cinema experience. So, you know, it's going to be a difficult couple of years transitioning into this, but when we get there, it's going to be worth it.
Yeah, totally. So let's wrap up on hardware. It's the end of the month, so let's have some end of the month picks from us. We're going to do movies in the movie section with Blu-rays and Ultra HD Blu-rays, but let's go to Ed, because Ed, we want your favorite vinyl pick for August. So if people are getting back into vinyl, what is the number one buy for them in your opinion this month for them to go and get and use on their new turntable? And also, let's have your pick of album of the month, whether that's streaming, vinyl, or whatever.
What I was actually instructed to do by Steve originally was ever so slightly different from this, but the good news is that it sort of still fits together, because the vinyl purchase of the month and album of the month are the same. And if you don't want to buy it on vinyl, you don't have to. It's available by a number of other means. And it is the fifth album by a group of chaps from Cumbria called Wild Beasts. And they've released an album called Boy King, which has actually got some pretty striking cover. It's got a sort of bicentennial man on the cover and some solid 80s font to back it up. Wild Beasts are a bit of an oddity. They have never released an album that sounds the same as the one that went before it. There are underlying themes that they use throughout, but they have continued to evolve and change. And it's sunny, it's hot, and it's just it's music to enjoy in weather like this. It doesn't take itself desperately seriously. It is just a lot of fun to listen to, and it has a really very good vinyl release if that's if your cup of tea. The pressing is good. Everything appears to have been put together with some degree of care and attention. It's not a rush job pressing. And if you buy it, you also, as a matter of course, get free access to a lossless download of it as well. So you can continue to enjoy it on other more practical means if you're out and about and so on and so forth. It's a very good listen. It's on all of the streaming services as best as I can work out, so you can legitimately try before you buy. I've been absolutely caning it so far. I think it's a cracking album. Steve also asked me about reissues. So slightly different, but I think this is just as important. It was actually released a little bit of time ago, a couple of weeks, nothing serious. If you are looking for something truly exceptional as a repressing, Moby's Play has finally been repressed onto vinyl. Why does this matter? Well, the long and the short of it is that when Play came out in 98-99, it did have a vinyl release, but that was 1,000 copies for the whole world. And it's fair to say I've never heard an original pressing, and the long and the short of it is that very few of us ever will. So I can't tell you if this pressing is as good as the original, because simply put, most of us will never have that opportunity to make a comparison. What I will say is it's a really, really, really good pressing. And then this feeds on to the fact that I don't know about you guys here, but when Play was everywhere at sort of 99-2000 sort of time, I grew heartily sick of that album, mm-hmm. and yep. I stopped listening to it. I sat down once I'd ordered when the repressing turned up, I sat down and listened to it. And with the benefit of literally not having listened to Play in over 10 years, I sat down and I listened to it, and it absolutely blew me away. It's one of those things where it was easy to become heartily sick of it. It was everywhere, but my God, it is a fantastic album.
If you revisit it
now, trust me, it will absolutely delight you.
There's still a regular listen on my playlist. Still comes round now and again, soundtracks from that. It was absolutely seminal album. Still is.
It's a sensationally good album. And repressing is excellent.
Wasn't it everywhere with regards adverts at the time? And that's what kind of caused people's fatigue.
Every track from Play was licensed by at least one company for advertising purposes. Every single track on that album. And I believe it was certainly the first time it's ever happened. And I don't actually know if it's ever happened since. It's unheralded.
One thing I will say in Moby's favour is that he is one of the most generous artists when it comes to young filmmakers and people trying to make their way in the business and looking for music for video or for their short films and that kind of thing. He is very, very generous when it comes to licensing. He will allow you to use it in non-profit making circumstances, like you're a film student or so on. So, he gives back quite a bit and very, very generous with his intellectual property.
Yes.
I also like the way that every single Bourne film, a different album I know, but every single Bourne film ends with Extreme Ways. It's quite cool.
It was a cracking track as well. I would also say, obviously, he's still very much active and is producing some cracking stuff at the moment. If you get to listen to Almost Loved, which he did with the Void Pacific Choir, it's a cracking track. Don't, for the love of God, listen to it whilst driving, because you will lose your license. But it's a really, really good tune. And he's been very, very busy and still producing some good stuff. But Play will probably remain his greatest work. Mm-hmm. And it's the part of the benefit of it taking so damn long for this repressing to appear is that we can finally listen to it again without the sort of sense of overfamiliarity. Just even if you're not messing about with turntables, just revisit it, sit down, listen to it as a continuous piece, and I think you'll be pleasantly surprised.
And unless you're one of these who has the original press and then now you're thinking, damn, this is going to affect the value.
How did they even distribute that?
I've no personal friends of Moby, I
like Willy Wonka's, a golden ticket or something.
It's hard to say. I mean, don't forget, back then it wasn't a big deal. in absolute sense of the word. So no, I don't know how it was done. And actually, it's funny. I remember some years ago, I was buying vinyl in a shop in London, and they had one of these original copies, and they wanted £100 for it. And I thought, that's quite a lot of money. I won't bother with that. and yes, that is laughably cheap for what they cost now. And suffice to say that obviously the market for first pressings is a different business anyway. Don't be under any illusions that you can pass one off as the other. The first pressings look different. They have different sleeves and they have different labels in the middle of the records and stuff like that. So this is not about getting in on something expensive. This is about enjoying a great album in a medium that few people up until this point have ever been able to do.
Okay, so that wraps up part of our news for this week, and we'll be moving on to Steve's sausage party in a sec. So, moving on to movie news and maybe some movie reviews, because we've had the reviews already, but Steve was saying to me yesterday that he was going to go and watch Brent and the Shallows, which is not a band. You're actually going to go and see David Brent and the Shallows. Did you? And what's your thoughts?
I did. Yeah, I did. I did. I saw David Brent Life on the Road, and then I saw the Shallows. David Brent Life on the Road, I quite enjoyed. I'm surprised at the amount of negative press it's had in some quarters, because I thought it was a really good attempt to take an existing character and then to update it in a meaningful way. I mean, I guess if people go into expecting The Office, they're going to be disappointed, because it is not The Office. None of the other characters in The Office are in this film. It's just Brent and his band Foregone Conclusion. And I guess you could say that Brent wasn't the main character. There were multiple characters in The Office, and maybe that made Brent easier to digest because you only had him in small doses, whereas when he's the subject of the entire film, it does mean you are confronted with him like the entire time. But what Gervais does, I think, which is really clever, is he takes a character that is a bit annoying, very annoying at times, and says the wrong thing constantly, but I don't think genuinely mean. I mean, he's not racist, but he says racist things by accident. He's not sexist, but he says sexist things by accident. He's totally clueless around women. But at the end of it all, I think he has a good heart, and he wants to be liked. And so the film is at times actually quite sad, because this is rather pathetic character's last roll of the dice, his desperate attempt to become famous, to take the fame, brief moment of fame he had as in with the concept of the film. You know, The Office was a genuine documentary, and he had this brief moment of fame, and now he's trying to take that fame and turn it into a pop career. And in some respects, Gervais himself is a failed pop star. And the songs, and if you've heard the songs, some of them are quite catchy and also really funny. I thought it really worked. I mean, and by the end, there was an emotional conclusion to it. I thought the film had earned. So ultimately, I found it funny, embarrassing, and moving in equal measures. And also thought some of the songs were actually quite good, much to my surprise. I enjoyed it, and I thought he did a pretty good job overall.
I've been listening to the album. The album is really quite good.
Some of the Native American is genuinely funny.
Yeah, yeah,
that is like an eagle, sit like a pelican.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing. This is what I had trouble with The Office. I didn't have as much trouble with the extras as I did with The Office, because I just found Brent so depressingly realistic, and excruciatingly embarrassing. So much so that I would be picking up the remote control to change the channel, because I was so embarrassed for the guy. So I know I'm going to have problems with it, with the film. I'm going to go and see it, but I know I'm going to have problems with that aspect of the character. But I found it with The Office, and you're saying it's more apparent here that actually he really is just a nice guy who just wants to be accepted and wants to have mates and just wants to be part of the...
That's exactly how the film's pitched. And I think the relationship between him and his friend, who's the black rapper who's in the band, is genuinely sweet, because as annoying as he is, the guy that whose name's Dom Johnson, it's just really funny. Dom, you know, he does care about Brent. He does care about him, even though Brent's not really helping his career at all, because he hogs all the studio time, basically, and doesn't really push him, even though he's quite a talented rapper. He's played by a genuine rapper. So that element works really well. There's some really touching moments in it. I thought it was good. I thought it was genuinely good, and I think I do miss you know, because The Office was written and directed, co-written and co-directed by Gervais and Stephen Merchant. Stephen Merchant is not involved in this. So it's very much a Ricky Gervais fest. And if you're not a fan of Gervais, you're probably not going to like it. But I thought it had genuine heart. And at the end of the day, that differentiates it from just being a series of embarrassing moments. And there are some of those, definitely. But I laughed out loud plenty of times in this film. But I also, you know, towards the end was getting a bit misty-eyed. So, great.
Was it a good audience experience?
I think the audience element adds to it to a degree in the comedy. But because it's not an out-and-out laugh fest in the way of some comedies are, where when people start laughing, it takes you along in the experience, it was more a question of isolated moments where you laugh out loud. And I could hear other people snickering and giggling around me. I think it's probably more subtle than your average comedy. Like seeing the trailer beforehand for something like Sausage Party, you know, where it's just out and out gags a lot of the time, you get a different response. Whereas this is more, it's comedy played at a realistic level. So it feels the response is less people rolling around in the aisles and more people laughing in recognition of the fact that it was funny and in recognition of the situation. I think people are so relate to it more. So it's relatable comedy rather than just laugh out loud, you know, rolling in the aisles comedy.
Okay. And the other one that you saw?
The Shallows. The Shallows is, as I mentioned last week, a shark movie, basically. And it's a bit of a film of two halves, because the first half of the film, the shark is kept very much, you know, a bit like Jaws. You don't see very much of the shark. You see bits of it, you know, moving through the water. You see brief flashes it attacks. And that works really well. But then in the second half of the film, the shark's very evident, you know, and it kind of does a thing like, you know, we were saying about Jaws would have been rubbish if the shark had worked. Well, this in the second half, the shark's, you know, is there a lot, and it seems to be taking things very personally. And I'm not sure whether real sharks would behave that way. So it kind of reduced a bit of the tension and what you can't see is always more scary than what you can see. And as soon as you see a big shark just chomping away at something, it kind of, even though in some cases the effects were done quite well, and in some cases the effects were not very good as well, which doesn't help. But I felt like they played, you know, they should have used the shark less, or shown the shark less rather, and stuck with just the, you know, her stuck on this little bit of rock. You know, when you don't know where it is, it's out there in the water, it's a lot more scary than when you can see a big thing coming towards you. But overall, I thought it was really good, because, I mean, the concept of just being, you know, this one girl, I mean, mostly just Blake Lively on her own, stuck in, you know, on this little bit of rock, trying to work out how to stay alive and get away from this shark. It's clever, and some of the things she does, you know, are very clever, and the way she sort of, and some of it's quite, you know, gruesome at times, certainly in terms of her trying to deal with her own injuries. So that bit works really well. I just felt like, you know, less is more sometimes, and they showed a bit too much towards the end. So it kind of fell a bit apart, certainly in the last 10 minutes, it fell apart. But at the same time, it was still exciting. It was still, there's some really big, real jump moments in it where you do jump in the air. Overall, you know, as shark movies go, it's one of the better shark movies.
Quite a
not
mixture.
Jaws by any stretch of imagination.
Damning with faint praise. The better shark movies. Wow. Is it better than Sharknado then?
Have you never seen it? I can't say, but I suspect so, yes.
Right, okay.
It's basically, if you think about it, it's a bit like a shark version of Phone Booth, which I think you said that last week, Phil. It's kind of a bit like that. You know, it's kind of very much in one location. But when they play it, you know, more subtly, it really works well. But like anything, I think when you start showing the monster too much, and not that the shark's necessarily a monster, but it is, you know, it's an animal really. But and they will argue that, oh, it's behaving, it's feeding zone, she's in its feeding zone, that's just trying to feed. But I don't know whether a real shark would eat three people and then, you know, keep on going. Seems like they'd have a bit of a bite and then go for a rest.
Go have a bit of a nap.
Put his feet up, cup of tea,
bit of time. Bit of a strange assortment of films to see in one afternoon, though, or one evening, Steve.
Yes.
Brent and then the shark movie. Yeah.
Yeah, very different. Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, I have eclectic tastes, so I don't mind.
Right, so moving on, films opening this Friday. This is another week where I have failed to go to the cinema. So this
after a promising early start,
it's really sort of gone downhill quite, but saying that, I've had quite a bit of work to do, and actually
have you got that pass though?
Yeah, I've got an unlimited pass,
this is coming across a bit like the January gym membership thing.
Yeah. which is kind of how I thought it might go, so we'll have to see what happens next month, because we're end of the month now, so it's paid for itself this month, because if I added up all the ticket prices for what I've gone and seen, it's £55. and the unlimited things, $17.99. So I'm ahead this month.
Yeah. In fact, you're ahead for next month too, really. If you don't go next month, you're okay.
Yeah, but I'm going to go next month. So there's some good films coming out. One I'm going to go and see because it's Pixar-related animation, but with Seth Rogen and lots of effing and blinding, and that's Sausage Party, and it looks great from the trailers, but my concern with this, Steve, is that it is all the funny stuff is in the trailers.
There's always that danger with the comedy, isn't there? You never know whether they kind of stick all the good gags in 2 minutes and that's it. But, I mean, I'm a reasonably big fan of Seth Rogen. I've certainly enjoyed Superbad and This Is the End. Other elements of other things he's done. So I know he can write. I know he can be funny. And the idea of an R-rated animation is quite appealing. Plus, watching the trailer again last night, I think it could be quite an interesting and subtle and rather intelligent commentary on religion as well. I mean, that's the concept, isn't it? The food thinks, you know, when you get bought from the shop, you go to heaven. Obviously, when they get bought, they find out they're being eaten. Because no one ever comes back to tell them the truth. So, you know, that sense of it commenting on the idea of heaven, I think is quite subversive and interesting.
What's really appealing to me is that the fact that they've actually spent a fortune on the animation here. And it looks like a genuine Pixar level of animation, and which again, just it kind of, there's something a bit strange about looking at animated characters like that using the F word.
Yeah, I guess it was pitched as Pixar with knob gags, and I'm all for that, frankly. That sounds great. I could definitely be up for for a bit of R-rated animation. It looks funny in the trailer, as you say. There's always a danger that maybe those are the only funny bits, but I suspect it will be good, and I shall be going to see it as well.
And what else is opening?
The other film opening is a film called Morgan. Now, I have seen the trailer for this, and it's one of those great trailers which teases you and makes it look interesting, but doesn't give away too much of the plot. So I really don't know exactly what this film is about, other than it seems to be about some scientists effectively creating a human being and then it going horribly awry. That's all I can work out from the trailer. They've either gently engineered a little girl, but she's a killer or something like that. But it does look interesting. It's got an interesting cast, got Paul Giamatti in it. And it's produced by Ridley Scott. So again, it's certainly piqued my interest in terms of the trailer by not giving away too much of the plot. So I don't exactly know what it's about, but okay. It looks interesting. So you can watch this teaser, this trailer, without worrying about it just giving away and everything.
Okay, I think I'll go and have a look at that after this recording. Right, so it, like I said, it is the end of the month. At least me and Steve's been at the cinema this month. Mark, have you been?
Schnew.
No. Ed? Was that a stupid question? That's a stupid question.
No, I did drive past one.
Right, so favourite movies in August. I've had a good think about this one, Steve, and I'd have to say my number one movie in August. Maybe it wasn't an August release, but I saw it in August, and that Star Trek Beyond is my favourite of the month. Closely followed by Suicide Squad, and I didn't think I would be saying that.
No, funny. I was thinking, I did actually see Star Trek in July, so technically it would be my favourite film of July. My favourite film of August is, and I can't believe I'm saying this, Suicide Squad. For all of its faults, I did really enjoy it. And, you know, as a fun night out at the movies, it was pretty good. Yes, it has its issues. We've discussed that.
It's serious issues.
Yes, it's got a massive third act problem. It's got a shitty villain. But I still enjoyed it. And of the films I've seen at the cinema this month, that was the one I enjoyed the most. So Suicide Squad is the winner, bizarrely.
And I've got to give a thumbs up and a recommended to Ghostbusters. And again, I didn't think I'd be doing that and saying that. Yes,
that was also good. I think, I mean, we've seen quite a few films in the last 6 weeks because it's a summer period. So, you know, Jason Bourne, Finding Dory, Suicide Squad, Star Trek, Ghostbusters.
Yeah, none of them were a disappointment. They're all entertaining in their own way. Bourne was just a Bourne film. So if you enjoy Bourne, go and see it because it is Bourne. Finding Dory was the only one that I thought could have been better. I came out thinking that could have been quite a bit better. But again, it was entertaining. And I'm sure the kids will love it. There's still enough there for adults, but maybe not enough, not as much as there was with the original Finding Nemo. But then I think it was kind of hard to sort of take that premise any further than they could, really. So, yeah, it was all right. It was for August, like you say, you know, summer holidays and that, we get a lot of big films. But I haven't seen a bad film this month so far. I am disappointed, though, that the Margot Robbie and Natalie Portman remake of Brokeback Mountain is not happening.
I'd be queuing around the block for that.
Well, that's what you call it these days.
Just rewatch that.
It was when that broke on Facebook, and I'm thinking, oh, Steve's going to be up for this, and then literally straight away, it's no, this is just somebody having fun. It's not real.
Did you hear an explosion somewhere in the West Country?
Yeah, funny enough, you were the first person that came to mind, which is kind of disturbing. Right, let's move on. Blu-ray releases this week. What can we buy that's good?
A bit of a quiet week again this week. It's been I guess because it's the big summer season for movies, there's not that much coming out disc-wise. So this week we've got a couple of some minor releases, really. One is season one of Narcos, which I have not seen, but people that have seen it, like Mark and Simon, think it's absolutely superb. It's basically the story of Pablo Escobar, and it's produced for Netflix. So it is available on Netflix. If you have Netflix, you can watch it on that. It's now also available on Blu-ray. And as with all Netflix productions, the production values are superb. So, you know, it looks fantastic. It sounds fantastic. So some interesting extras. And apparently it is an absolutely gripping TV series. And I have to say, after reading the review, I might, when I get a chance, start watching that, because it did sound really interesting, with an interesting cast. And, I mean, you know, and the story of Pablo Escobar is certainly got its elements to it. And obviously they take the real facts, the actual facts of the story, but they do mix in a certain degree of fiction as well, or to keep it interesting. But it was conceived as a, you know, like a lot of these Netflix series, to conceive to be binge-watched. Therefore, you know, he's telling one continuous story. That sounds interesting. The other film coming out is Sid and Nancy, which was made by Alex Cox back in the late 80s. It was the first film starring Gary Oldman, who plays Sid in this. And obviously it tells the story of Sid Vicious and Nancy Sponge and their doomed relationship, and ultimately her death. I'm not going to say murder, because I think it may have been accidental, but her death and then Sid's death as well, although they don't show Sid's death in the film. It's one of those films, it's a bit difficult to watch, because whilst it's very well done, very well made, very well acted, very well directed, you know, at the end of the day, there's something slightly depressing and boring about watching a couple of sad, pathetic junkies, you know, sort of living in their squalor and dying. You know, is that really something you want to spend 2 hours doing? I watched it last weekend. And I can honestly say, no, I don't.
Okay. Any UHD Blu-rays we need to be worried about this week, Steve, as we move into September? Because September looks like being a big month.
It does, actually. September's becoming a particularly expensive, in my case, month. Because we've got some... So basically, this is how it's panning out for September. And it's all stacked towards the end of the month, has to be said. There's a couple of releases in late September, Labyrinth and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Then in the end of September, we've got Warcraft, Everest, Central Intelligence, The Shallows, and a film called Mike and Dabney Wedding Dates. Moving into the first week of October, we've then got X-Men Apocalypse, X-Men First Class, Pacific Rim, Jupiter Ascending, and The Great Gatsby. And then new, announced just this week, this is for the 18th of October, one for you, Ed, Independence Day Resurgence is coming out. So that's going to get an Ultra HD Blu-ray release towards the end of October.
All I need to do is buy a UHD television and player, and I'm still probably not going to buy it.
You see, you can polish a turd.
You can buy the release, Ed, and just watch the Blu-ray until such time as you have an Ultra HD.
I could, but I was just looking at stuff I've got on Amazon pre-order. In a completely different format, let's leave it at that, and it's looking quite expensive.
So yeah, and unless it comes up out on holographic vinyl, I don't think Ed's going to be buying it, Steve. I think that's what he's trying to say.
The thing is, actually, that Force Awakens vinyl with the holographic thing, there's only one plant which is actually capable of doing that, and they've now got sort of firm orders all the way through until about 2019 for people that have suddenly decided that that's exactly what they want. So yes, look forward to more of those in the course in the not too distant future.
Sorry, when you said there was just one plant capable of doing that, I thought we were talking about hallucinogenics here.
Well, that can turn anything you own into a holographic label. I mean, you know, your results may vary, but yeah, I couldn't possibly comment on something like that, Mark, because it would be illegal and bad.
Blu-ray release with peyote.
I could certainly improve some films.
Yeah. So again, end of the month, let's round things up, Steve. So what are the big Blu-rays that have happened this month that are really worthwhile picking up?
For my money, and this is a late entry.
That's anything, Steve. So that doesn't cut things down, does it?
Late entry, only saw it this week. But if you're looking for absolutely reference Blu-ray. 2D and 3D, a soundtrack and image, but also a really great film and a technological tour de force. The Jungle Book, absolutely stunning. That's sadly no Atmos soundtrack, even though it had one in the cinema, because Disney don't currently support immersive audio. But aside from that, it is an absolutely stellar reference, Blu-ray. So I'd highly recommend that. As far as Ultra HD Blu-rays go, my pick would be Batman vs. Superman. Not necessarily the greatest film, but absolutely stellar package in terms of picture and sound. You know, you've got a 4K DI on that film, so you're getting the full 4K. Some of the scenes were shot with IMAX cameras. It's HDR 10, so you've got, you know, you've got HDR, you've got the wider color gamma we were talking about earlier, you've got the full 4K image, and it comes with a Dolby Atmos soundtrack, which is absolutely thunderous, and it's the full 3-hour cut. So it's a triple layer Ultra HD Blu-ray, the first of those to be released, and it's, you know, worked perfectly. So I think as a sort of statement of where Ultra HD Blu-ray is going, that for me is my pick in terms of image, sound, extras, an overall performance and you know, features. It's just stunning. So
Batman, it's a shame Batman. It's just 3 hours of unrelenting death and misery, but you know, we'll gloss over that.
It's 25 quid to pick that up at the minute, Steve. That's is it worth 25 quid?
I guess it depends on your point of view regarding Batman versus Superman. I think if you're looking for a state-of-the-art Ultra HD Blu-ray though, and something to really show off the system to your mates, definitely worth picking up. If you like the movie, the longer cut is better, so that's probably another good reason to get it. If you didn't like the movie, you're probably not going to enjoy the longer cut anymore, but I think it does make a lot more sense, so you might find it preferable. I certainly wasn't a massive fan of the film, but I did find the longer cut a lot more bearable, bizarrely, even though it's half an hour longer. Because of the extra scenes, it does make the plot more sensible. So that's another reason. It does look stunning, though. So, you know, if you're looking for 25 quid, toppy, but you do get quite a lot for your money, I think. So, you know, you'd be paying that for a 3D Blu-ray anyway. So,
right, so let's move to our favourite TV shows in August. And there's been a lot of great TV, I've got to say. Really got into Mr. Robot. I finished season one. I'm now about 3 episodes off on season two. I've got 3 episodes to catch up on. I think I'm on about 5 or 6. So that is living up. Start of season two, a bit slow to get started again, because you had the crescendo at the end of season one. Season two, like I say, it builds up. And for, I mean, you said to me, Steve, that you thought you were going to give up on it at one point in season two. It's worth sticking in there, actually, and going with it, because it is ramping up again to something else. So definitely worth it. If you haven't seen Mr. Robot season one, go watch it. It is superb television. The other one for me, you've been banging on about it for weeks, Steve, and that's Stranger Things. I've still got 2 episodes to finish the series. The reason I'm taking my time is I don't want it to be over, because I am so enjoying this. It is absolutely stunning television. I wouldn't even call it television. I'd just call it a really long movie, an 8-hour long movie, because it is so well put together. There's so much love and attention paid to the period that it's set in. The characters, the clothing, the wardrobe's fantastic. It is like...
And the synth. Don't forget. Well,
give me a chance, Ed. I was coming on to the soundtrack. The soundtrack is absolutely stunning, and hopefully they're going to release that as an album, because there is absolutely stunning music in there. And the whole sound mix as well. I mean, you've got to listen to this on a big system. Don't watch it on the TV. Watch it on your home cinema system. The way that they use low frequencies, and you don't realise they're using it unless you're really paying attention, because it's so subtle the way they do it. But every time there's something happening, let's call it supernatural, the way that they use low frequency, fantastic, really is, and it gets the pulse racing, and it is a Spielberg cross Stephen King, as you described it, Steve. It is, you know, you kind of believe that they haven't had their fingers in this, because it is such a love letter to that period of time and those films, and the strangeness and the supernatural feeling of things. And the kids, big thumbs up to the kids as actors, because they all pull it off. There's not a bad, the only bad performance in there is Winona Ryder at one point. She feels a bit fake when she's trying to be upset. She can't quite do that. She can't quite pull that off. She can pull off the psycho bit quite easily, which is probably not a surprise, but it's the other emotions she struggles with. But the kids are absolutely fantastic, and the acting is superb. my pick of the month. Go watch it now. Put down this podcast and go and watch it.
I'll wait until it's dark. That's much better. It's better once night falls, I would say that. Because we don't all have rooms that we can create perfect darkness in film.
Yeah, it's superb. It is everything Super 8 should have been but wasn't. It's my pick of the month TV wise, definitely. And I love some of the little touches are brilliant. If like me, you bought a lot of Stephen King books in the 80s. The typeface for Stranger Things, the actual title card, is an exact copy of the Stephen King writing these for his name on those books back in the 80s. It's a fantastic series.
Well, I'm afraid I was sold on it as soon as Ed said the synth. So that's what's going to make me go and watch it.
Yeah,
love a bit of 80s synth.
Yeah. It has, and that's another big plus point of Mr. Robot as well. The soundtrack of Mr. Robot, synth-wise and electronica and so on, really, really good. And again, there doesn't seem to be any playlists or anything out there that actually has music from the series, so hopefully they will release an album. Okay, so that's our favourite TV show in August. Go and watch it. It is on Netflix. It's well worth... how much is Netflix now? I think it's $8.99 if you want 4K. Is it still $5.99 for HD only? I can't remember.
$6.99.
It's definitely worth the months just to go and watch that. So go and watch it. Right, anything else, Steve?
A couple of quick bits of news. We haven't had any Star Wars news yet, so I'll just point out that if you're a fan of Rebels, which I am, season one was absolutely superb. Season two, which looks like it's going to be even better because Darth Vader is in it, that comes out on Blu-ray on the 4th of October. And also, and it was announced yesterday, so this is breaking news as far as I'm concerned. Forbes have been doing their highest paid actors. So the highest paid actress in the world last year was Jennifer Lawrence, and the highest paid actor in the world last year was The Rock, who earned, I believe, $67 million. He's knocked Robert Downey Jr. off the top spot, who's been number one for the last 3 years, thanks basically to Iron Man and the Avengers. But The Rock, largely thanks to the Fast and the Furious films, but also thanks to some of his own stuff like San Andreas, he is now the highest paid actor in the world. And he tweeted about it and said, "I started with $7 in my pocket." So it just shows you anyone can do it. So
and really he's had true. To spend it all on protein shakes.
I was going to say, it's not really true because he is, you know, a big bloke. So if you want to be a wrestler or something, you have to be quite large to start with. So if he was 4'2" or something, you wouldn't be able to, you might find it a bit more of a struggle.
Yeah. Protein shakes and trousers he's split.
Baby oil. Don't forget the baby oil. That must be quite expensive in by the gallon. Yes, so I think I'm not a massive surprise because he has been in some very high-profile films recently, and you know he seems quite canny in the way that he manages his career, and also he's pretty hardworking. He's knocking out a couple of films a year, easy. So he's a hardworking guy. He seems like a pretty nice guy, very personable, certainly charismatic on screen, and good luck to him. So well done, The Rock.
Steve loves The Rock.
Absolutely.
Anyway, on that bombshell, I think that is that's about all we've got time for on the podcast this week. So my thanks to Steve Withers.
Silencio.
Ed Selly.
Acting is reacting. Sorry, shall I do that again? Acting is reacting.
And?
I've got to put your name in, Mark.
Huh?
I forgot to write. But
I noticed that. I thought...
Mark Portwright.
I agree with what you said, truly.
Don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Bookmark AV Forums for latest reviews, news and videos. And of course, we forgot to do it at the end of the month yet again. But we'll keep it as a surprise. You have to keep in listening in to hear your name being read out. If you leave us a 5-star rating on iTunes, remember it has to be 5 stars, no less. And leave a witty comment, you're more likely to get read out then. So leave those. I'm Phil Hinton. Thank you very much for listening. And we'll see you again next Monday.